that's working. Okay. I'll present some work on exploratory data analysis that we recently did with some collaborators at Labyrinth Livermore. The general setup is that we are given a sample from a high-dimensional scalar function, and we are interested to visualize explorative structure of the function. So here, xi would be samples in the domain. We usually restrict ourselves here to a Euclidean domain of d dimensions. And at each sample, we know the function value of that point, yi. So here's two examples. I'll start with two examples to motivate why you would be interested in that. The first data set is the communities and crime data set from the UC Irvine machine learning database. And we use that to sort of illustrate the method. So here, the FBI collected socioeconomic variables from about 2,000 counties in the US, such as population density, how many people live in an urban environment, number of persons per family, income, and they measured the crime rates in this in these counties as violent crimes per capita. And so we would be interested in what leads to a high crime rate, what are the settings that lead to high crime rates, is there multiple ones, what affects the crime rate. The second example is more what actually drove the development of this work. It's climate simulations. The climate scientists at Labyrinth Livermore National Lab, they run multiple simulations, and these simulations have 21 input parameters that they can adjust. And depending on how they set the parameters, they get a different result. And in this case, they measure the flux, the thermal radiation leaving the Earth. And they're interested if I change one of these variables, how does this affect the output? So this is simple in 2D, right? If you have a sample from a function, a 2D function, as shown on the left, we can build a regression or an interpolation of that function and just visualize the function. We get a global overview over the function. We see where the peaks are, where the valleys are, etc. In higher dimensions, we can't do this, obviously. So people have looked at many ways to deal with this. One approach is to reduce the dimensions, so squash them into 2D or do something a little smarter and assume that there's some manifold structure and uncover this nonlinear structure. Here shown, for example, is face images represented in a three-dimensional space. And then we can look at the labels in this three-dimensional space of the face image. An alternate approach is to try to show the whole data, actually, and such as, for example, parallel coordinates or Andrew plots or the grand tour. And here the idea is, for example, in parallel coordinates, to project the whole data set onto one coordinate at a time and show all the projection at once. More recently, people have looked at preserving topological properties of the data and build a representation of that. There, the idea is that we can compute the topology of that function and represent it on a 2D height field. However, this 2D height field is not unique. There is multiple arrangements that lead to the same topology. So what we are aiming for in this work is to sort of give the same intuition or same representation to the user as a height field over a 2D function, so a global summary of the height field of the high-dimensional function. And the strategy we take here is we extract the most important features first, such as extremal points and minima and maxima, and region of similar behavior of that function. And then in the second step, we reduce this sort of summary representation of this surface or hypersurface to arrive at the two-dimensional representation that we can actually visualize. So here's the sort of methodology we use in this work. So given a high-dimensional function, we first segment this function. In the second step, we build a summary representation for each segmentation. And in the third step, we reduce this summary representation to two and three dimensions. I'll go now through each of these steps and explain how we arrive at this summary representation. So the first step is the segmentation, and here we use the Morse Mail complex to arrive at the representation or a segmentation of the domain that splits the domain into pieces. with similar grading flow with a single source and sink. So each of these partitions has now only one minima and maxima. The way we compute this thing is based on an approximation. We can't compute the exact Morse smell complex. We don't know the function, we're just given samples. So the idea is to build a nearest neighbors graph, then use an approximate steepest ascent and descent on the graph to extract the extremal points. So each vertex is now associated with the minima here shown in blue or and the maxima shown in red. And this gives us finally the partition of the domain of our samples into the pieces of the Morse smell complex. So the partition is based on the points that have the same min and max. So there's much work on Morse smell complex computation, and most of it's focused on 2D or 3D manifolds, piecewise linear functions, and there's some fast algorithms to do that. But in higher dimension, there's not that much work. There's recently some work by Chazal et al. That proves some bounds on how well we can approximate the Morse smell complex or persistence diagrams in that case, which are related to that. So once you have this segmentation, we build the summaries for each partition of the domain. And this we do with the regression curve. But the regression curve is sort of the inverse. So given a function value, what's the average domain value that gives me that function value? And we do this for each piece of the partition of the domain. And here it's important to note that we're not actually estimating the surface, but the inverse. So this is a representation of the domain and not the function value. And here, now we can see why it's important to first decompose the domain. So if you would just do this inverse regression over the complete domain, a lot of information would be lost. For example, in this 2D example, we have four peaks. If you do directly, just say, average all the red values, we get a single maxima that doesn't represent one of the peaks actually at all. If you first do the decomposition into the Morse smell complex, we get multiple regression curves, and each corresponds to an actual peak of the surface. So far we have this segmentation based on the Morse smell complex, and we obtain these monotonic regions. We build a summary of each partition with regression, but we are still in RD. These regression curves are in the domain space and just d-dimensional. We can't really visualize them. So the last step is to put this representation into 2D. And the first thing we do is we say, well, the location of the extremal points is sort of important, so we focus on those first and embed those. And the approach we take here is we take all the extremal points and perform a 2D principal component analysis, which embeds our points in 2D and preserves the direction of most variants of the extremal points. In a second step, we embed the regression curves. So here we are, for each partition, we have one of these regression curves. So we can build a piecewise linear approximation to this regression curve by sampling it, and then again use PCA to embed it into 2D. And in the last step, connect them to the corresponding streamal points, min and max. So now we have this sort of graph network, which summarizes where each arc summarizes a piece of the domain. And we can visualize that in 2D, and that's what we do here. And we use the third dimension to actually map the function value. So that it's sort of a height field over the graph. And we use color redundant with the heights for mapping the function value. So red would here correspond to a high function value and blue to a low. So additionally, we can add more information to this visualization. Given the regression curve, we can measure what's the projection distance onto that curve for each data point in that partition. And this is here shown with the transparent tube around the actual arc regression curve. And the shading of that tube indicates how many samples do we have in that part, which gives another piece of important information back to the user. And finally, we allow the user to select one of these partitions with the what I call here a location slider. And then we can additionally plot what the actual function value, variable values are at that location, the mean of the regression curve and the standard deviation, or give a more global overview, here shown in the regression curve graphs, where you plot each variable as a function of the function value. So this gives you sort of a global overview how each variable behaves in this partition. So here are some 2D examples to give you some sort of idea of how this representation looks like for 2D examples. So if you look at the far right examples, the four peaks, you can see, for example, that the flat peak now is represented with a high standard deviation, and the very sharp peak has a low standard deviation because you only have a few samples there and they're close together. So this standard deviation gives you sort of an idea how spread out that peak is, or is it a really sharp peak. I'll now go to some real world examples. First, to illustrate the approach, I'll use the crime data I used in the introduction. And here we see, if you look at the overview representation, we see that we have a single minimum and three max. So there is sort of three different ways we arrive at high crime rates. And if we dig into this and say, let's see what happens, for example, in peak one and look at the regression curve there, we can see, I zoom into one of the specific variables of this 100-dimensional space. Oops, sorry. Play it again. I wanted to pause the movie right there. So what we can see is that two of these three peaks have a large percentage of urban population. So here you can see the urban population. And additionally, you can see that there is a low medium income. So it's sort of expected, this behavior, right? So that's one of the peaks. Now I select the other peak, and here we can see this is one peak where we have a low urban population and a low income again. And we can, for example, look now at the third peak again, and here is again, it's one in urban population, but interestingly, this one had a high median income. So that would mean we should go look further. What else can we look at? Oh, there is low unemployment in that peak. So this gives the user an idea what would be worth testing in this data to see what's going on. So you can sort of build new hypotheses to test on that data. And here's the same data set with a parallel coordinate plot compared to our approach. Here I used five discrete levels of crime levels for the parallel coordinates plot. And while the parallel coordinate plot gives an idea which variables might be interesting to specifically look at, you don't get like a good overview on how this function looked like. So the next example is the climate simulations I talked about. Here we have 20 man parameter settings, and the output is the thermal radiations. And the climate scientists run 500 simulations with different parameter settings. And now we show how this function roughly looks like based on this sample. So here we find, again, a single minimum, a single setting that leads to low thermal flux, and two maxima. And we gave that to the climate scientists and Lawrence Livermore to look at it. And what they found interesting is that here we have, they highlighted two of the variables there, CMF tau and tau, which are related to cloud formation. And here we can see that if these are not in balance, then we get a high thermal flux. And what they hypothesize is that if they're out of balance, this hinders cloud formation, and thus a lot of radiation escapes. So this is sort of a new insight they gleaned from this data with our tool. And here's a comparison to show that it wouldn't be easy to see this otherwise. So we can, for example, do a regression on CMF tau or tau, and that pretty much looks flat if we do it over the whole data set. Whereas if we split it up at the more smell complex first and then look at these two different regions we found, we can clearly see the behavior of CMF tau and tau, the opposite behavior, and that they are out of balance when they are not at their peak values. So to conclude my talk, I would make you aware of the demonstration at the Ski Open House where I will run my software. And if anyone has any interesting data he might interest in to look at, please contact me and I will try to run it and then we can look at it. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you for this interesting talk. I'm sure there are some questions. If you have questions, please come up or I can also come with a microphone.
Very good work. My question essentially is the following. We know that PCA in general doesn't do a very good job in preserving neighborhoods, especially for visualization in 2D. So why do you choose PCA instead of a more appropriate technique to spread points in 2D preserving neighborhoods?
I'm not actually interested in preserving neighborhoods. I have a few extremal points, very few points. And I want to preserve their location as best possible. And I have no knowledge of an underlying manifold structure or anything else. So I would say PCA is probably easier for the user to interpret as some nonlinear that might distort the reduction in unexpected ways.
Okay. We have time for more questions.
Nice work. You described how the envelope around the tube was computed, but you didn't describe what the ring, the colored ring, was around each tube, and how the shading was done.
Could you speak up a little bit? I couldn't quite hear the whole
I'm
question.
Sorry. If you go back to one of your pictures or animations, sure, anyone. How about the one just previous? Sorry, that one where you say location slider.
Yes.
There's a colored ring around it. Can you tell me what the color ring is?
Oh, that's just actually the function value at that point. So okay. It corresponds to color on the regression.
So it's the same as the string that's going through.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. Do you have any ideas about the limitations? I fear if you have many minima, maxima, then you're really also lose in a 2D picture, like
yes,
yourself.
So if you get many minima, maxima, you get intersections. And so what we did is we allowed the user to select the region he's interested in, like clicking on one of the regression curves, and then blend out the pieces that are not connected to it to look at this in more detail.
Okay, yeah, that
makes
sense.
And the limitations, I mean, it's the more smell complex in high dimensional space is not that well understood, I believe. So depending on how much data you have, you're only able to detect a few minima maxima reliably.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, may I have a follow-up question on that? Did you think about like flattening this whole thing? Because now it makes like weird turns and stuff, which is somewhat difficult to follow. Wouldn't it be more intuitive to have like a 2D layout of that whole thing?
A 3D.
I mean, you have in the third dimension, you have your function value now. So
yes.
It's like a 3D curve. But wouldn't it be more intuitive to have it like as a 2D curve? And since I don't know what the additional purpose is of having a 3D curve.
I think it gives the user an idea of the actual height of the function, so you cannot look at it from the side and you see where it's high and low. I mean, it's redundant with color, but I found it easier to navigate the. But clearly, you can also just say 2D and leave 3D out. That's clearly an option.
Okay, thanks.
Is there? Oh, there's another question.
So you have this first step where you approximate the Mohr smell complex with this nearest neighbor graph.
Yes.
Do you have any sort of theoretical guarantees/stability results where maybe you don't get the min-max pairs of small persistence, but with some sampling, you're always going to get the ones of high persistence, or
there is
before you do the embedding, even then.
Yeah, there is a result by Chazelle that I mentioned in the slides, which bounds your persistence diagram based on your sampling.
Okay.
So there is some results, but we don't have any in this paper, so we just sort of use this as a tool to arrive at this representation.
And then as soon as you then do the 2D embedding, is there any notion of the higher persistence gets embedded better or anything like that? Or
We ran some empirical tests, and it's sort of, for moderate dimension, it's sort of capable of picking out the important peaks and valleys.
We even have time for one more question. Actually, I also have one. So it's basically a whole pipeline that you use to process your data, and every step involves some reduction or quantization. So is there a step that you consider the most crucial, or do you have worst case examples where your representation becomes unstable, meaning when you change the parameters a little bit that you end up with different visual encodings?
I do not have any worst case examples, but I think the most crucial step is the more small computation. So it can easily be that we have two peaks, and depending on how many k-nearest neighbors we choose, we might connect to regions that we shouldn't connect, and then we lose that region in effect.
Yeah, thank you again for your nice talk.